The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance.com. That is G-S-U-G-G-S Insurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated March 13/March 20, 2023. It is, as usual, bordered in red with a narrow white border on the front cover. And up at the top left corner, it says our 100th year. Time, in large block lettering, is in gray, superimposed upon darker gray, featuring a portrait of actor Cate Blanchett, that is C-A-T-E-B-L-A-N-C-H-E-T-T. This is a formal portrait in black and white and denotes the Women of the Year aspect of this edition of Time magazine. Cate Blanchett is looking directly at the lens of the camera, dressed in a dark, probably black, shirt or sweater with a bit of a turtleneck or a high crew neck. She has her face in her right hand, so the right side of her face, left if we're facing her, is resting on her hand. She has blondish hair, apparently, again this is in black and white, short, cropped, don't know what color her lip coloring is, nor her eyes, but it is Cate Blanchett, one of the Women of the Year, as indicated by Time. Beginning with the brief, Two-Way Main Street, by Alana Samuels, the U.S. economy is strong, but with high interest rates, it is not all good news if you are not rich. The numbers keep rolling in to confirm. Things look very good in the U.S. economy. Employers added 500,000 jobs in January, more than twice as many as economists had predicted. Spending by U.S. households rose 1.8% over December, and retail sales jumped at a higher rate than they had for nearly 2 years. You would think it would be time to kick back, sip a martini and celebrate, but it is not. The continued strength of the U.S. economy means the Federal Reserve's efforts to slow inflation by increasing interest rates are not working as quickly as they had hoped. Inflation rose 5.4% in January from a year ago, according to data from the Fed's preferred index released February 24. The Fed wants inflation to be around 2% and will keep increasing interest rates till it gets near that target. Whether it should give up on that target is a question the Fed does not seem interested in pursuing at the moment. The consumer is the stallion running wild, and the Fed is the cowboy. And the Fed will win at the end of the day, says Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Already, the Fed has raised interest rates from near zero in April 2020 to a 15-year high of above 4.5%, the most aggressive policy since the 1980s. Officials do not expect to reduce interest rates till at least 2024. If you are not someone who needs to borrow a lot of money in the foreseeable future to buy a house or make another big purchase, you might not think the Fed's moves are relevant to you, but they are. Higher interest rates also increase the cost of having a balance on a credit card. They make it more expensive for businesses to borrow money. When companies have higher expenses, they are going to look to either raise prices or cut spending. That often means layoffs. One reason we've seen tens of thousands of tech layoffs in recent months. What happens next as the Fed works to slow inflation could be especially painful for those at the bottom half of U.S. income distribution. Consumer spending is what is driving the hot economy right now, but it is mostly consumers in the top half of that income distribution who are doing the spending, Sandy points out. Recent data suggests the U.S. economy is not going into a recession anytime soon. The higher income households saved so much money during the pandemic, they seem relatively unfazed by inflation, continuing to shop, eat at restaurants, and travel, despite rising prices. But low and middle income households have run through the savings they accumulated during the pandemic, Sandy says, and are reeling from high prices. They're also finding it's getting more expensive to push back a credit card payment a month or two. For families at the lower end of the income spectrum, shifting the burden of debt on a monthly basis can rapidly become unbearable, says Gregory Dacko, chief economist at EY Parthenon. He predicts a K-shaped consumer spending pattern this year, with higher income households continuing to spend, while lower income households slow their economic activity. There are already signs this is happening. Darden Restaurants said in an earnings call that households making less than $50,000 were eating less frequently at its Olive Garden and Cheddar's restaurants, but it was still seeing strength with guests in higher income households. Walmart posted better than expected earnings February 21, and the company said that growth was driven by higher income consumers. Meanwhile, credit card debt is at a record high. The share of loans that are 30 days or more delinquent is rising after 2 years of relatively low rates. As lower-income consumers' stimulus savings run out, programs created in 2020 like extra money for food stamps are expiring, which will increase the struggles of low-income families. Already, because of inflation, the typical American family has to spend $400 more per month than a year ago to buy the same goods and services. Dacko estimates the top 40% of households account for about 60% of consumer spending, and that their share of spending has increased during the past few years as they have accumulated money while largely staying home. These wealthier households can continue to keep spending and prop up the economy for a while, he says, but that cannot last. Eventually, the economy is going to feel the loss of lower-income households and their spending power. Their absence puts pressure on higher-income households to spend more, and they may start to balk as they see prices keep rising and interest rates remain high. There are still plenty of reasons to be optimistic, Dacko says, but there are also reasons to worry. Household finances are healthy, says Dacko, but we're starting to see cracks in the foundation. From the brief news, here's a photograph of... oh, goodness, two-thirds of the page. It's in color. It's in a stadium, possibly outdoors, because the top margin is very dark, like it's a night game. And there are lots of lights on the upper tiers of the stadium, which looks to be packed. But again, there are so many dark, shadowy recesses away from the camera lens, it's inexplicable. It's called emotional support. There's green turf in the background. There are black-clad individuals in the foreground. Another with black pants, shorts actually, and a white shirt, and two more with red shirts and shorts. And in front of them, a sea, absolutely a pile of stuffed animals. Goodness, hundreds or thousands of them, in this one corner of the field of the stadium. Turkish soccer fans threw thousands of stuffed toys onto the pitch of an Istanbul stadium February 27 for children affected by two devastating earthquakes in the region. Because the first quake struck at 4:17 a.m. February 6, the Besiktas and Antalyaspor teams paused their game after 4 minutes 17 seconds of play for supporters to toss in their contributions, meaning all the stuffed animals. The Bulletin by Minnie Racker. Fresh debate on the origins of COVID-19. The U.S. Department of Energy now believes COVID-19 most likely resulted from an accidental leak from a Chinese lab, according to news reports. It made the conclusion with a low level of confidence, the Wall Street Journal reported February 26, citing anonymous sources. Not every U.S. intel agency agrees with the Energy Department. There is not a consensus right now in the U.S. government about exactly how COVID started, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said February 27. A 2021 report from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence revealed that of the nine groups that investigated COVID-19's origins, five decided transmission from animal to human was the most likely cause. February 28, FBI Director Christopher Wray told Fox News the FBI has for some time believed a lab leak was the most likely explanation. Two agencies, reportedly including the CIA, remain undecided. The details of these investigations, including methods, sources, even the names of all of the agencies involved, remain largely hidden from the public. The Energy Department and CIA have not commented. Andrew Weber, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, says the Energy Department, which operates several national laboratories, was likely able to employ sophisticated scientific methods in order to make its conclusion about COVID-19. Congress is pushing for more transparency. James Comer, chair of the House Oversight Committee, wants the Energy Department to declassify its assessment. Wray said China has been doing its best to thwart and obfuscate COVID-19 origin investigations, but it is vital to push for answers, Weber says. The fact that the intelligence community of the United States of America believes both scenarios are plausible, he says, is enough to lead us to change some of our policies. Well, unfortunately, that really didn't say anything. The brief news. Good question. Why are publishers rewriting classics? By Armani Syed. Only days after a British publisher came under fire for edits made to Roald Dahl's children's books, The Telegraph revealed February 25 that James Bond was getting the same treatment. Just as Dahl's books would be adjusted to remove language that today's readers deem offensive, the estate of Bond author Ian Fleming has conducted a sensitivity review before an upcoming reissue of the spy novels. It is hard for anyone to argue in favor of the language in question. In Dahl's case, offensive terms relating to race, gender, weight, and mental health have been rewritten. In Fleming's, language describing black people has particularly come under the microscope, though Bond's notorious attitude toward women will reportedly remain. The reaction to the news is a case study in both why such a decision would draw scrutiny and why publishers and authors' estates may see it as in their best interest regardless. Dahl, whose works have sold more than 300 million copies worldwide, is an illustrative example. In the years since his death in 1990, some have turned their focus to a number of racist and sexist tropes in his works. Before his death, too, in the first edition of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Oompa Loompas were pygmies from the deepest and darkest part of the African jungle. That changed after pressure from Dahl's publisher. Puffin Books, a children's imprint of Penguin Books, worked with the Roald Dahl Story Company, RDSC, which is now owned by Netflix, to review the texts before issuing new editions. RDSC says it hopes the resulting rewrites ensure that Dahl's wonderful stories and characters continue to be enjoyed by all children today. The review was conducted with Inclusive Minds, an organization that works with the children's book world to support diversity and inclusion. The group told Time they do not write, edit, or rewrite texts, but provide book creators with valuable insight from people with the relevant lived experience that they can take into consideration. Hundreds of changes have reportedly been made to Dahl's body of work. These edits include a line in James and the Giant Peach, recast from I'd Rather Be Fried Alive and Eaten by a Mexican, to I Would Rather Be Fried Alive and Eaten. In Matilda, a mention of going to India with English novelist Rudyard Kipling, who's been variously labeled a colonialist, a racist, and a misogynist in recent years, has been cut, and a reference to Jane Austen has been added. Some critics, like Suzanne Nozzle, CEO of Pen America, have argued Dahl's work should stand as it is, with new introductions to prepare readers with context. In a Twitter thread, she wrote, "The problem with rewrites is that there is no limiting principle." And Booker Prize-winning author Salman Rushdie tweeted, "Roald Dahl was no angel, but this is absurd censorship." Amid the backlash, Penguin Random House announced February 24 it would continue to publish classic versions of Dahl's books alongside the revised versions. Yet Karen Sands O'Connor, a professor of children's literature at Newcastle University, says there is a precedent for rewriting texts, including the Oompa Loompas, and a reason publishers go to the trouble. She says they have three choices: stop publishing the work, lose money, continue publishing the original texts and with controversy, or tailor the text to today's audience. Sands O'Connor says the third is the least problematic option, but an even better approach is discovering new and exciting authors. The books are out there, she says. People just need to look for them. The brief news, Nation on the Front Lines of the Culture War Over Black History, by Olivia B. Waxman. When it came time for Emmett Glynn to teach the lesson on the Black Panthers in his AP African American Studies class, he says he was overcome with fear walking into his classroom at Baton Rouge Magnet High School February 17. Fear that what happened in the room would be misconstrued by the outside world. The school has been fielding so many media requests about Glynn's class, administrators set up a day for the press to come and see the curriculum in action. The Louisiana school is one of 60 nationwide pilot testing, the College Board's newest advanced placement course, designed to offer college-level instruction to high school students. The element in the AP African American Studies lesson on civil rights history that had Glynn worried was the Black Panthers' 10-point program. Required reading for the course, the 1966 document demanded equal opportunities for housing, the end of police brutality, the release of black people from jails because they did not get fair and impartial trials. The media crowded into Glenn's classroom about a month after the Florida Department of Education rejected the AP African American Studies class, turning it into a lightning rod in the debate over how black history is taught in public schools, including how much of the history of racism students should learn. Shortly after it was revealed, the agency had asked the College Board last fall, "Does the course promote Black Panther thinking?" The Black Panthers have long been stereotyped as violent and communist. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who is thought to be eyeing a possible 2024 presidential run, has put culture war issues at the center of his administration. He called the class indoctrination. "I've never experienced something like that in my teaching in 29 years, Glenn says, having to feel I had to take careful steps with a subject because it might make people upset. On the day local journalists were invited to the class, reporters saw Glenn teach about Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham jail. The subsequent coverage resulted in no local scandal in Louisiana's capital city and no national controversy. Glenn's press conference is perhaps an extreme example of how AP African American Studies teachers say they are working hard to prevent the controversy over the class from disrupting the students' education. Teachers from Texas to New England tell Time they cannot ignore the controversy around the class and how black history is taught more broadly. Many say, though, that DeSantis' objections have only made their students more engaged. Austin Sparks turned the controversy into a teachable moment for his class in the Cleveland area. He and his students discussed parallels between Florida's decision to ban the course and subjects they had already covered, like Jim Crow laws, which also restricted access to black history. Students were throwing up their hands left and right, making connections to what we have learned so far," Sparks said. Two schools in Florida stopped AP African American Studies pilots mid-year after DeSantis spoke out against the class in January. The course is more than a decade in the making, but launched in 2021 in large part as a response to the murder of George Floyd, so high school students would not have to wait till college to learn about police brutality and other issues affecting the black community in historical context. In New Orleans, teacher Lamont Simmons says students voiced concern their class could be canceled too. He says participation was highest during the lessons about African kingdoms. As he puts it, if black high school students don't learn about the black history that came before slavery, your perception of yourself is limited. Despite his nerves, Glenn is going to open the door and keep it open to his AP African American Studies class. He invited parents to come and observe any time, and a local pastor approached him about designing a similar course for his churchgoers. "I'm not going to be intimidated," he says. Mr. Glenn and his class are shown in a small color photograph here. It looks like a classroom. White walls, white boards, a white screen on the wall for movies or whatever is being shown these days, PowerPoint probably. Kind of a linoleum, sandy-colored floor. Now, the class is multicultural, multiracist. There are African-American students and others of lighter and very light skin tones, boys and girls, it would appear. Mr. Glenn is speaking with one student in the front row of the class. All the students, or each of the students, is seated at her or his desk. Mr. Glenn is African American. He's wearing glasses. He has close cropped black hair. He's wearing a white shirt, a striped tie, a matched pair of pinstriped dark gray trousers and vest, and he's wearing black sneakers. From the brief Milestones announced Malcolm X lawsuit. This is by Nick Popley, P POPLI, NYPD, FBI, CIA face accusations. Civil rights leader Malcolm X's family marked the anniversary of his 1965 assassination, February 22, by announcing plans to sue the FBI, New York Police Department, CIA, for $100 million, claiming they concealed evidence related to his murder. For more than half a century, the circumstances surrounding the assassination have been shrouded in mystery, fueling conspiracy theories about possible government involvement. Two men who were convicted of murdering Malcolm X in 1966 were exonerated in 2021 after serving decades in prison, and the New York District Attorney admitted that it had not had access to the FBI and NYPD's exculpatory evidence. The city and state of New York in 2022 paid $36 million for their wrongful conviction. A third man who admitted to the killing was paroled in 2010. For years, our family has fought for the truth to come to light concerning his murder. Ilyasa Shabazz, daughter of Malcolm X, said at the site of the Audubon Ballroom, now a memorial, in New York City's Washington Heights neighborhood, where the 39-year-old was shot 21 times. Undercover NYPD detectives and FBI informants were at the scene, neither of which was disclosed. Court filings allege government agencies conspired with each other and with other individuals, and acted and failed to act in such a way as to bring about the wrongful death of Malcolm X. Civil rights lawyer Ben Crump, who's representing the family, repeatedly referenced J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director who died in 1972. It is not just about the trigger men. It is about those who conspired with the trigger men to do this dastardly deed, he said. Suspended. New START Nuclear Treaty by W.J. Hennigan. Russian President Vladimir Putin suspended his nation's participation in the last remaining nuclear arms control agreement with the U.S. February 21, condemning the West in a bitter speech that sharpened tensions over the Ukraine war as it enters its second year. New START limits each side to 1,550 deployed nuclear warheads. The 2010 agreement is a legacy of arms control infrastructure hammered out during the Cold War, when the U.S. and Soviet Union identified weapons deemed mutually menacing and worked to eliminate the threat. While the implications of Putin's move remain unclear, the U.S. believes his decision imperils the bilateral communication, data exchanges, and site visits that provide insights into the two nations' strategic nuclear forces. Died Richard Belzer, B-E-L-Z-E-R, who played Law and Order SVU detective John Munch at 78, February 19. David Jolicoeur, member of music trio De La Soul, at 54, February 12. Capped, the out-of-pocket cost of insulin products, at $35 per month by drug maker Eli Lilly, the company announced March 1, a major price cut to the medication. Seen, six galaxies dating back as far as 500 million years by the James Webb Space Telescope, according to a paper published February 22 in the journal Nature. Dropped, comic strip Dilbert by newspapers, its distributor, and its book publisher, in a cascade beginning February 25 after creator Scott Adams' racist remarks about black people. From The View, Dear Ukrainians by Sebastian Junger, or Junger, J-U-N-G-E-R. Junger is a journalist and filmmaker am the author of the books Tribe, Freedom, and War. Dear Ukrainians, you've been at war for a year now, and death must have touched virtually every family in your country. Your struggle reminds me of Sarajevo, where I first experienced war as a journalist in 1993. The Bosnian Serb army had besieged the beautiful Bosnian capital, and ordinary citizens, many just teenagers, learned to use the tools of war to defend their families and homes. The situation was both noble and tragic, inspiring and sad. It made me want to be Sarajevan. It made me want a great cause in my life that would require me to put others before myself. You seem to make yourself immortal when you do that. You seem to make yourself impervious to pain and fear and doubt. The reality is much more complicated, of course, but over and over throughout history, ordinary people defending their homes and families have found themselves capable of feats they never could have imagined. My father was a refugee from two wars. In 1936, he and his family fled Madrid when the fascists came in under General Francisco Franco, and then fled again when the Nazis invaded France. It looked as if fascism was going to take over the world, but some people knew better. All of Western Europe's authoritarian regimes have collapsed since World War II. Of the Eastern Bloc countries, only Russia and Belarus have slid back into authoritarianism. Europe is an overwhelmingly democratic continent because there are people everywhere who were and are willing to risk their lives defying evil. Resistance fighters in France and other occupied countries joined Allied soldiers in World War II to crush the Nazi regime and eradicate fascism in Central Europe. The Ukrainian resistance is a direct descendant of these heroic citizens. Like Hitler, Putin will fail in his endeavor. Not only will he fail, but it will eventually destroy him. As a result, other dictators around the world will take note of the fact that smaller countries often win wars against invaders, and that invading a supposedly weak neighbor will probably end in failure. History is filled with inspiring examples. The Ottoman Empire invaded Montenegro over and over in the 1600s, outnumbering the Montenegrins by as much as 12-1. Each time, these mountain people drove out their invaders, often inflicting high casualties. And after the failed Easter Rising of 1916, Irish rebels eventually overthrew English rule, despite the fact they were hopelessly outnumbered and outgunned. Freedom is one of the few things that throughout history people have regularly been willing to die for. That can make invading a free society very costly. But a fight for freedom will not succeed without leaders who are willing to make the same sacrifices as everyone else. Without brave and selfless leaders, ordinary people will have little reason to believe the society they're fighting for will be a fair one. All free societies accord full rights and respect to women. A cause that sidelines women will probably fail for lack of popular support. Not only do women confer a kind of moral legitimacy to political causes, but women's social networks are often lateral rather than hierarchical, a huge asset for any underground movement. Because of your success against Russian forces, China may hesitate to attack Taiwan. North Korea may think twice before declaring war on South Korea. Russia may abandon claims to the Baltic countries. Western leaders clearly understand the fight for Ukraine is a fight for peace and stability in all of Europe, if not the world. They've remained united in their commitment to providing advanced weapons and ammunition, as well as tactical training by some of the West's most elite special forces. President Biden clearly wants to send Ukraine the maximum amount of military aid without triggering a catastrophic backlash by Putin. As the war continues to go in Ukraine's favor, many Americans hope he will choose a moment to provide enough arms for a decisive victory. In human societies, it is possible for a smaller individual or group to defeat a larger one. Otherwise, the world would be dominated by fascist megastates, and freedom would not be possible. But that is not what the world looks like. Smaller countries like Ukraine can stand up to the powerful dictatorships and fight them to a standstill, particularly when they have access to advanced weapons and tactics. If Ukraine remains free, other countries will remain free as well, because fascist leaders around the world will be forced to understand that power does not always triumph. In fact, as often as not, it fails. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, China's Fraught Plan 2 and the War in Ukraine. There's a photo here. It's in sepia tones. The foreground features or has imagery of tall brownish tan grasses. This may be the natural coloration. The background fades into a dull, very dull grayish blue horizon and sky. And in the center foreground, a Ukrainian is on the front line in Donetsk Oblast, Ukraine, January 29. The soldier is dressed in full camouflage with helmet and long rifle. With its 12-point plan to end the war in Ukraine, China has taken a significant step toward center stage in international politics. In the past, it has avoided the risks and responsibilities that come with a leadership role on foreign policy questions that are not directly relevant to China's national security. Now that Xi Jinping has consolidated vast power at home, he is ready to assert his country's influence in new ways. Yet direct intervention in Russia's war on Ukraine is fraught with risk for China, its relations with America and Europe, and the entire global economy. What is in China's peace plan? Despite Western suspicions that the proposal is designed mainly to help Russia, it calls for formal respect for Ukraine's sovereignty, protections for Ukrainian civilians, an end to interference with the flow of humanitarian aid into the country, and condemnation of the possible use of nuclear weapons. The plan also reflects the views of those around the world whose primary interest in the war is economic, by calling for a ceasefire and end to sanctions and the opening of peace talks that might help ease pressure on food and fuel prices. Though Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, pledged to consider the plan, it has no chance of moving forward because it does not require Russia's invading army to leave Ukraine, does not promise a return of Ukrainian land now illegally occupied by Russian forces, and provides nothing tangible for reconstruction of the country. An immediate ceasefire would freeze Russian gains in place, forcing Ukraine to try to persuade Vladimir Putin to voluntarily give back land. In truth, no peace plan is likely to succeed at this stage of the war, because neither the Russian nor the Ukrainian government can afford to lose. In addition, though Beijing has rejected the charge, Western governments continue to warn China may still be thinking of providing weapons for Russia. Direct accusations from senior U.S. officials that China is considering the idea make clear Washington is watching closely, and serious consequences will come if China presses ahead. For that reason, Beijing is unlikely to send Russia weapons or ammunition, but it surely hopes the threat alone will move NATO to push Ukraine to the negotiating table. So what else does China hope its plan can achieve? It can promote China as a global problem solver and peacemaker with a blueprint most of the world can support. Though developing countries in Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East question Putin's motives. They see themselves more directly damaged by Western determination to make this war the most urgent priority in a world suffering from global crises, like slow economic recovery from the pandemic, food and fuel inflation, unsustainable developing world debt, refugees, and climate change. China's peace plan implicitly presents the U.S. as a warmonger and NATO as the tool it uses to make an awful war last longer and cost more. It also allows Xi to interact with Putin and even to visit Moscow in coming months as a mediator rather than as an ally of the man who ordered the invasion. China may also be hoping to drive political wedges within America and Europe by creating an off-ramp for those on both sides of the Atlantic who question the wisdom of open-ended support for Ukraine. China is playing a dangerous game. Any provision of weapons to Russia would instantly make an already fractious U.S.-China relationship much worse. The aftershocks from that quake would be felt around the world. But even if China continues to limit its involvement to the role of Kremlin apologist and gadfly would-be peacemaker, the impact on tensions between America and China may help ensure the world in the war in Ukraine continues to expand in ways no one can control. The View Inbox. The Leadership Brief by Eliana Docterman. Since taking over as CEO of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences last July, Bill Kramer has been putting out fires. The Academy is still dealing with the fallout of Will Smith slapping Oscar host Chris Rock, and in January, a celebrity-backed campaign that some accused of violating Academy rules powered Andrea Riseborough to a surprise Best Actress nomination for her performance in the little scene To Leslie, boxing out black actors who had been considered contenders, Viola Davis and Danielle Deadwyler. The Academy launched an investigation but decided not to rescind Riseborough's nomination. Kramer spoke to Time about the controversies and adding a crisis team for the big night. Academy President Janet Yang recently said the response to the slap was inadequate. What would an adequate response have looked like? Answer: let's hope something like this never happens again, but we could have moved more quickly. And I'm not just talking about the night of the show. This is really our response after the show and how we spoke about it and how we talked to Will and Chris and our members. Question: are there any measures being put in place for this year for surprises? Answer: we have a whole crisis team, something we've never had before. We've run many scenarios, so it's our hope that we will be prepared for anything that we may not anticipate right now. Question: I cannot conceive what coming up with scenarios looks like. Answer: because of last year, we've opened our minds to the many things that can happen. But these crisis plans, the crisis communication teams and structures we have in place, allow us to say this is the group that we have to gather very quickly. Obviously, depending on the specifics of the crisis, and let's hope something doesn't happen and we never have to use these, but we already have frameworks in place that we can modify. Question: you recently issued a statement about Andrea Riseborough. Do you expect similar social media-fueled campaigns to spring up next year? Answer: I think social media is a space where, if used properly and used in an ethical, kind, fair way, is a great leveler. I think it can be a good thing. We just need to put some guardrails around that. Question: speaking of equity, the woman King was snubbed. Director Gina Prince-Bythewood has talked about, and maybe you've read. Answer: I had lunch with her 2 days ago. Question. She said white actors can launch campaigns that rely on social connections in Hollywood in a way that many black women and women of color cannot. What should the Academy's role be in making sure that campaigning is equal for everyone? Answer. In our industry, there is sometimes a resistance to looking at certain roles and genres as being award-worthy. As an academy, we work very hard to ensure our members see and engage with them. To Gina's point about not a lot of people wanting to see The Woman King, because academy members did not think it was the sort of film that they should be considering, we need to break down those barriers. The film was remarkable. It was a critical success. It was a commercial success. For the same reason, Top Gun Maverick is being considered a Best Picture candidate. The Woman King should be in that conversation, as well as many others. It is critical for us. I hate that this happened, but I think we all want to see this as a silver lining moment and do something about it. The DC Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. Abortion is still available in South Carolina until 22 weeks of pregnancy, but intense efforts are underway to limit access. Dozens of state lawmakers back a bill that would make people who get abortion subject to the death penalty, and another that would ban the procedure after 12 weeks. From afar, such fervor among conservative politicians to take advantage of the U.S. Supreme Court's Dobbs decision makes sense. The state has loud and rowdy pockets of deeply conservative and religious individuals, and its politics reflects that tradition. But the latest data tell a different story of a post-Dobbs world. Last year, 50% of South Carolinians said abortion should be legal in most or all cases, up from 48% in 2018, according to the Public Religion Research Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. In fact, roughly two-thirds of all Americans say abortions should be legal in most or all cases. The 65% measured last year was up from 55% in 2010, according to PRRI surveys of tens of thousands of people. And religion, it turns out, is not as predictive as you would think. For decades, it was assumed Christians were the main driver behind the anti-abortion rights movement. But PRRI's new survey says white evangelical Protestants, Jehovah's Witnesses, Latter-day Saints, and Hispanic Protestants are the only blocs who do not have majority support for abortion rights. Even among Catholics, the support for abortion rights tops 60%, including 61% of Hispanic Catholics and 62% of white Catholics. Among Hispanic Catholics, support for abortion in all cases doubled since Dobbs, moving from 16% in March to 31% in December. Taken together, it's clear faith alone is not the power it once was. Conservative politicians in South Carolina and elsewhere are chasing an agenda out of step with most of their constituents. I'll begin this article, which will be abridged. The View essay under Nation, Welcome to the New American Dream by Alyssa Quart, Quart. The classic leather boot has had many names over the years: Lace Up, Cowboy, Congress, Pale Rider. To get your work boots on your feet 200 or so years ago, you would stand up and grab two small leather flaps on the sides, known as boot straps, and pull the boot up. From this everyday activity, the idiom to pull yourself up by your bootstraps was born, and with it a torturous myth that true success meant getting ahead on only your energy and steam, without help from your family, government, or community. While it was initially understood to be an absurdity, over time it became a phrase that millions of people take seriously. The phrase is now arguably the basis of the American dream and its embrace of an individualism that shades into a brittle self-sufficiency. For years, I've been struck by how much the self-made myth shapes public opinion and policy. As a reporter focused on inequality, I frequently see this relentless individualistic stance, even in the messages I receive from readers about how the poor are responsible for their own scarcity, strangers wagging their proverbial fingers at single mothers or people who have been evicted. They are following decades of instructions that Americans have to accomplish everything on our own, from poor women being called welfare queens during the Reagan era, to today's Republican politicians opposing college debt relief as a debt transfer scam. But there's also a very different version of the American dream from this one. It is closer to what was first imagined by James Truslow Adams in his 1931 book on the subject, more inclusive, more communitarian, less singular. It is catching on. You can see it in the rise in the number of people joining or attempting to create new unions, and in the range of citizens now helping decide the budgets of their local governments. These are just two examples of the new American dreamers that taken together show collective action and community-focused activity are growing in popularity. Their numbers include people who are joining psychological subcultures that operate like mutual aid networks of the mind, with what one practitioner called survivor-centered and survivor-aware care. Sissy White, one counselor in a kind of new peer-to-peer counseling community, was a trauma survivor herself. She led webinars during the pandemic, sharing memories of her extreme poverty and neglect as a child, including the father she knew living unhoused. But while all of this suffering could have hardened her toward those less resilient and made her self-focused, it had instead made White more rigorous in her generosity. Another woman spoke of her own abject poverty in childhood and young adulthood, how she once spent her days drinking so much I was dying. White nodded in acceptance. A chorus of attendees also responded. While the need for mental health care is often cast as an individual failing, those who are rethinking mental health care believe we should not have to hustle to access assistance or attempt to get healthier through self-help alone. The fight for this new American dream tends to require both social smarts and organizational abilities. For example, that is what people needed to participate in the mutual aid groups that have risen up around the country since the pandemic. Local strangers connected by Google Groups, Google Calendars, and calling trees to bring groceries, eyeglasses, and medication to one another. They placed fridges in urban areas with complimentary food inside. In 2021, there were an estimated 800 such groups nationwide, but informally, scholars who study volunteerism told me there were many more, and that article has been abridged. And another short article with abridgment, not just kid stuff. November 23, 1970, when Time set out to tackle the debate over children's TV in late 1970, a year after Sesame Street premiered, correspondent Mary Cronin was sent to interview one of the show's puppeteers and ended up posing her questions directly to Oscar the Grouch instead. The story sent the message to Time's grown-up readers, Sesame was a cultural phenomena, and that its medium could serve a higher purpose than just entertainment. The past half century has borne out that verdict, as well as the wisdom of the editor's choice of cover subject, Big Bird. Here in the tradition of Cronin's work, Time asked Big Bird to weigh in, as only he could, on the enduring power of his home and how to celebrate a centennial. That's by Lily Rothman. Question, Sesame Street seems like a special place. Answer, all my friends live there. We have a lot of fun. We play all kinds of games, and we learn a lot together. Question, what can kids learn from seeing what life is like there? Answer, I've learned everything I know on Sesame Street. I guess I'd say it's a place where everyone is included and everyone is kind to one another. And if you're ever having a bad day or a tough time, there's always a friend nearby to help you feel better. Question, what about grown-ups? What can they learn? Answer, sometimes when new neighbors move in or people come to visit, I hear them say they've never lived in a place that is so kind and welcoming. And I agree. Well, I've never actually lived anywhere else, but I guess that's what grown-ups could learn, to be super welcoming. Question, you must meet people everywhere you go who are interested in what goes on Sesame Street. Why do you think that is? Answer, it's true. Everywhere I go, people have heard of Sesame Street. I'm not sure why. I guess maybe it's a little unusual to have birds, monsters, fairies, grouches, snuffleupaguses, and humans all living in the same neighborhood, learning and having fun together. Do you have that in your neighborhood? We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.